It's the NPR News Update for Monday, March 4th. Minnesota's news on your schedule, available each weekday right here. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, we hear about legislation that opens early education to more students. It's about jobs versus the environment in northern Minnesota. Questions for Xcel Energy, which wants to increase your rates. And we hear from Governor Mark Dayton. Supporters of early childhood education say this could finally be the year Minnesota gets serious about educating young children. Governor Dayton is pushing to expand preschool and child care scholarships for poor kids. He wants to increase the current funding from $3 million to $25 million, which he says would help an additional 10,000 children across the state. Parts of his plan are modeled after an ambitious experiment in St. Paul. 5 years ago, business leaders there rallied together to offer early learning scholarships to low-income families, convinced that capturing young minds before they arrive at school would save money in the long run. Reporter Laura Ewan has our story.
Mariah, come brush your teeth.
We like to think in Minnesota, kids can make it in life with quality classroom instruction, starting in kindergarten. But at the Bigelow Head Start program in St. Paul, learning comes much, much earlier. At the restroom faucet that comes up to my knee, 3-year-old Mariah knows to brush and swish as part of her morning routine. On cue, the students pick up their toys. And they're fostering a bond with trusted adults, including one of their teachers, Miss Viviana Gattica.
What is Miss Vivi doing?
Party circle.
Is this a circle?
No. No. Okay. Okay, what is it?
I don't know. It's a surprise.
The program was one of several St. Paul preschools that participated in the pilot program that launched in 2008. Business leaders with what was then known as the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, or MELF, raised several million dollars for the scholarships and a rating system known as Parent Aware. One parent who benefited was Candy McDonald, whose daughter is 3-year-old Mariah. And about 5 years ago, McDonald used the scholarship to enroll her first child, Kendrick, in preschool. Head Start does not charge tuition, and McDonald qualified to enroll Kendrick in a half-day program, but the scholarship enabled her to send her son to school all day. The fact that Kendrick could even go to school as a toddler opened this young mom's eyes.
Because I was in my early 20s, and I didn't know what age they can actually start. I just thought that maybe he had to be 5. So scholarship meant, like, thank you, Jesus. It meant that he can go to school every day and do what he loved to do.
Then a single working mom, McDonald also received home visits from parent mentors. They came bearing kids' books that now fill a bookcase in her apartment. She says the visits also taught her to be patient with her son.
It helped me realize that Kendrick's not going to see things through my eyes, and my job as a parent is to see things through his eyes.
One reason behind the push is a growing consensus that Minnesota needs to do a better job of boosting achievement for kids of color. No one knows why the state has some of the nation's largest educational disparities between white and minority children. McDonald, who is black, says Kendrick, now 7, is doing well in the Roseville Elementary School. She credits the early learning programs for both of her kids and says they'll help them overcome barriers later in life.
It's hard out here for people of color. I wanted to make sure that education wouldn't be one of them.
But do the programs actually work? When considering all the research about early learning, it's best to break it down into 2 categories, the money and the brains. First, the brains.
My name is Megan Gunner. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota and director of the Institute of Child Development.
Gunner says it's taken 40 years for Minnesota to latch on to evidence showing the benefits of intervening early in a child's life.
What we're talking about now has been in the science community for a very long, long time.
Think of a newborn brain growing similar to a house under construction. Gunner says experience in the early years of life is what wires the basic architecture of the brain together.
Skills beget skills, and the regions of the brain that are critically important for higher reasoning and thinking and academic functioning are affected by the way those earlier structures have gotten set into place. So the achievement gap begins very early.
But early education has come under scrutiny recently, with studies showing that the academic gains demonstrated by kids enrolled in Head Start fade out by the time they enter later grades. Yet Gunner maintains that preschool improves kids' ability to reason, plan, and control their behavior, and those benefits can last a lifetime. And that brings us to the money argument. Economist Rob Grunewald of the Federal Reserve in Minneapolis and his former colleague Art Rolnick concluded that for every dollar spent on early education, the return is up to $16. It was their research, first published a decade ago, that led to the MELF scholarship program. But Grunewald says the benefits can seem intangible to policymakers focused on immediate results.
To fully achieve this high return, you wait until kids are graduating from high school, they're earning more money, they haven't committed those crimes, we are producing less social assistance. So it takes some vision in order to say, hey, now I'm going to make an investment today that's going to not pay out fully in a year or two. It's going to pay out in 5, 10, 15 years down the road.
At the Capitol, there could be resistance from some conservative legislators who think early education amounts to government overreach, and in a tight budget year, every program will come under scrutiny. Tom Dewar is president of the Teachers Union Education Minnesota. Dewar says his group supports pre-K programs, but says its first priority will be all-day kindergarten.
Kindergarten first, because that's where the foundation starts. We don't want an education donut hole. Because if you have 3 and 4 year olds that go to this program and then they don't have all day K, they're going to slide back academically and socially.
The group also prefers that any efforts to expand early education go to preschool programs based at the school district. Currently, parents can use the scholarships to send their children to quality private and family-based facilities. Still, key legislators believe there's enough momentum and money in the budget for both all-day kindergarten and early education. With the backing of the advocacy coalition MiniMinds, lawmakers have introduced bills that would support the pre-K scholarship model. Those proposals suggest spending more than $180 million over the next 2 years. That's more than 3 times the amount Dayton has recommended.
Laura Ewan with that report. Governor Mark Dayton joined Carrie Miller on the Daily Circuit to talk about a number of pressing issues. Here's some of that conversation.
There seems to be some disagreement about why the state's in better fiscal shape and why we got the kind of news that we did last week. Now, Republicans are arguing that this is really about the economic growth from policies that they put into place when they had the majorities in the House and Senate. Well, tell me what your argument is for why this budget picture looks a little better in the forecast.
Well, as John Kennedy said, success has 1,000 authors and failure is an orphan. So, you know, the fact that it's seen as a success, which it is, you know, opens the door for everybody to come in and claim credit. I've given the Republicans credit for the budget cuts in 2011. I wish they'd been more willing to compromise on the other parts of it. But, you know, I'm willing to acknowledge that. And that's fine. We can all share the credit. You know, the real driving force is the national economy. And that's where it's kind of humorous, because the Republicans all last fall were criticizing the economy and blaming it on President Obama. And now that they've turned around and they're claiming credit for it, they think it's successful. So, you know, it's hard to have it both ways. But the main thing is that we are moving ahead. We, you know, as you said, $463 million reduction in the projected deficit for the next biennium. And, you know, $290 million surplus for the rest of this biennium goes by law to pay back more of the school shifts. We repaid almost $2 billion of the school shift from previous years. And so we're on the right track. And our job growth last year was of all the states, 12th highest in the country. So, you know, nothing to be complacent about or satisfied. There's still too many people out of work and there's still too much to do, but we are making progress.
Do you look at that money and say, given what you're calling for in your budget, for increased income taxes on high-income Minnesotans and a broadening, but a lowering of the sales tax, but a broadening of the sales tax, and say, we may be seeing more revenue in coming years than we've even projected for. Maybe we don't need the kind of tax increases that you've been talking about.
Well, so-called tax increases get all the attention. I'm $1.4 billion in my budget would go to property tax relief, to reducing every homeowner's property taxes by $500 this year and the years to follow. As you said, lowering the sales tax rate by 20%, we go from 6.875%, where we're the seventh highest rate in the country, down to 5.5%, where we're 27th in the country. And the average family would not pay any more in sales taxes given that shift of broadening the base and lowering the rate. So you ask people, well, do you want to pay no more in sales taxes? You pay only, unless you're in the top 2%, you pay no more income taxes, and you get a $500 property tax rebate. I think most people would find that pretty attractive and should. So, you know, it's hard to get all that worked into a 7-second soundbite. And, you know, the people who don't pay taxes now on purchases who would have to, businesses and others, are strongly opposed. And they've opposed everything I've ever proposed. They've opposed, the businesses paying on sales tax. They've opposed my raising income taxes on the top 2%. They've opposed everything else. So I don't know where we go with that kind of attitude.
So, Governor, it sounds like my question being, if the economy is improving and you can anticipate perhaps that there will be more revenue coming in than you've even projected, if we continue on this path, it does not sound like you are reassessing some of those tax increases that you've called for.
Oh,
given
I'm definitely reassessing, and I said I would come out a week from today, at the latest, with a revised budget, as I did last 2 years ago when we had about $1 billion reduction. I mean, none of us can foresee the future in the economic forecasting, which is a nationally recognized econometric firm and our best minds in Minnesota, private sector and public. You know, they're making assumptions about future economic growth. They're predicting the state and the nation will track pretty closely together. So that's built into the forecast. But we, by the statute, have to just deal with the forecast as it's presented to us. And next forecast will be next November, and no doubt that'll be different from this one. And when the economy is improving, yes, you're right, there tend to be more revenues, and we also have less spending thanks to the reforms in healthcare that Commissioner Lucinda Justin has championed. So we've cut spending, and revenues are increased, and that's a good sign.
So, Governor, just a moment ago you said, I'm definitely reassessing. Which of the tax increases are you reassessing?
Well, as I said, I'm not going to sort of speculate on it now. I haven't had a chance to talk with my senior staff or revenue or MMB commissioners. We're going to do that this afternoon, and we need a couple of days to crunch some different numbers. But there's $423 million in less of a deficit for the next biennium than we've been expecting. So, as I say, that's good news for Minnesota, and it means we have other options.
Can I ask you this? I know you're aware of some of the feedback that you're getting on the sales tax, what this means for businesses, and what consumers are saying about that, and we'll hear more about that, I think, in just a moment. But is that feedback and some of the dislike of what you've proposed going to weigh in as you reassess, given what we're seeing about the budget and increased revenues?
Oh, absolutely. I said when I made my initial budget proposal that this was the first word on the subject, and the legislature and I will have the last word. 5 months later, so this is a conversation ongoing with Minnesotans, and I'm listening carefully and clearly hear the concerns of businesses to paying sales tax on the services they buy. So definitely it's going to be a factor in my consideration.
To the phones to Ben in Excelsior. Hi, Ben.
My question for Governor Dayton is that there's a new bill proposed in the House regarding excise taxes on small brewers, vineyards, and distilleries in Minnesota. Supposedly, this increase of about 400% in our state excise is to fund alcohol abuse programs, drunk driving education, things like that. And I was wondering where your stance was on that, given that the majority of consumption is coming from larger brewers out of state, larger distillers that have nothing to do with us. So it feels like, as an employee of a small brewery, this money is being taken from us as we try to grow in order to pay for the damages caused by much larger non-Minnesota businesses.
Hey, Governor.
I don't support any increased taxes on alcohol, and there's no increased taxes in my budget on alcohol consumption or the production of it, and your point is very well taken. It would be very unfair to our in-state breweries, which we want to encourage all we can, and put them in unfair disadvantage against out-of-state competition.
To the phones to Paul in Circle Pines. Hi, Paul. Your question
for
the governor.
Thanks for taking my call. And I was just calling because I'm kind of concerned about all these taxes. And And retirees in the state, you know, we're one of 14 states that tax Social Security. And then we have a $1 million estate tax for single people, which is not real high today with people's 401ks. I'm just concerned that we're going to be chasing the people that have money out of Minnesota with these taxes. I don't want to be known as a land of 10,000 taxes with all these new taxes you're proposing. I would hope that you would reconsider and really think about keeping retirees in the state of Minnesota. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you, Paul. Well, we certainly want to encourage retirees to stay here and enjoy our wonderful Minnesota winters and everything else that we have to offer. I'm not familiar with the state of state tax, I'll admit, so I'm going to have to look into that one and see. Both of these have been in existence before I arrived. Taxing Social Security is taxing income. And I guess, given that we are still facing a budget shortfall and we need those existing revenues, we're not in a position right now to be eliminating any of those kind of taxes. And again, I guess I philosophically think that if somebody gets a dollar of income, they should pay at the same rate as somebody who gets a dollar from somewhere else.
Governor, I want to play some of the comments that were made at the House Tax Committee hearing last week on some of your, specifically, it seems like sales tax proposals here. As you know, many of the objections are coming from business owners on your plan to broaden the sales tax. Here's just a sense of what some of those business owners had to say.
So this will just begin to eat right into that recovery immediately.
Please think about it this way. Millions of dollars will be added to the current cost of providing services. Health insurance will go up. Education tuition will increase. And the overall cost of local government will rise.
This tax, as it's proposed today, would be absolutely devastating to the state of Minnesota.
Governor, what do you say to some of those remarks?
Well, the same things have been said before when Governor Perpich, Governor Ventura tried to broaden the base. People who don't pay taxes don't want to pay taxes. I understand that. No one likes to pay taxes. And, you know, right now with the goods that are taxable in Minnesota, businesses are treated almost the same way that consumers are. You buy a new computer, you buy new furniture, you buy new carpeting for your business or for your home, you pay the same sales tax rate. Now, when they talk about broadening the base, I had sort of assumed naively, I guess, that that was going to be a same way across the board. Everybody would be treated the same. Well, it turns out that most business people who are advocating broadening the base and who support the additional expenditures that I'm proposing in areas like education, they want to tax consumers, but they don't want to pay taxes themselves. And I just think that's unfair. But that's the reality. That's how they perceive it. And, you know, I take the business climate issues in Minnesota very seriously, so we're taking a look at it on that basis.
Do you buy the argument that when you hear business owners say it's going to put us at a serious disadvantage, we're going to lose customers because of this, our businesses will not thrive because of this? Do you buy that argument?
Well, nobody wants to pay more taxes. And if businesses say, you know, it's going to be a detrimental effect on their businesses, I mean, I can't dispute that without looking at their books. There are some probably that are in serious financial distress, and this might be conclusive. There are others who, you know, are reported to be in financial distress and then pay their outgoing temporary CEO $12 billion for 8 months' work. So I can't distinguish between those two categories of businesses. I do know that my goal is to have taxes be fair, and that a dollar earned is a dollar tax, a dollar purchased is a dollar tax, the same way for across the board. And we have a great inequity now in our tax system. Middle-income families pay 26% higher share of their income in state and local taxes than the top 1%. So we've got all these inadequacies and all these injustices. And, you know, but trying to change that, trying to reform it, people focus in on the one thing they don't like, and they overlook everything else, and you have to look at it as a whole package.
But you indicated when you answered that question that you know, the business community has objected to this in other governors' plans, and that this is just long-standing recalcitrance on the part of the business community paying additional taxes. But isn't it fair to say that the business community has been open-minded at other times on the idea of tax increases? I mean, they supported a tax hike to fund transportation over the objections of Governor Pawlenty. They are not just monolithically across the board opposed to tax hikes, are they?
Well, the chambers of commerce, especially in greater Minnesota, were key in passing the increase in the gas tax. Right. So you're absolutely right, Harry. And they recognize the benefit of that. And, you know, I mean, businesses are not a monolithic group, and they're different views. And they, you know, certainly contributed enormously to exactly the kind of recovery that we were talking about before and the improved state budget situation. So, again, I take their concerns very seriously. You know, I don't know who specifically was involved in opposition to Governor Perpich or Governor Ventura. I know that they both tried unsuccessfully to broaden the sales tax base, but I don't know the particulars of either of those situations. But, you know, in this case, you know, I understand that they're not paying taxes on purchases of services now, and they don't want to pay taxes on purchases of services in the future. And, you know, the only, you know, real quarrel I have with that was that many of them turn around and say, "What? But tax consumers." And I'd have a very hard time taxing consumers and not businesses when we've been treating them all the same up until now. So, you know, if we have to do away with both of those, then we've got, you know, a very different budget situation, and the options for other kind of reform, the property tax rebate, $500 a homeowner is going to be very difficult to achieve. But, you know, those are the trade-offs that the legislature and I will be considering in the next 3 months.
That's Governor Mark Dayton and Carrie Miller on today's Daily Circuit program. It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Public hearings are scheduled this month for a proposed rate hike by Xcel Energy. The utility wants to increase rates by 10.7%. The State Commerce Department is on the record saying the rate hike is too high. Xcel Regional Vice President Laura McCartan talked about it this morning with Kathy Werzer.
Xcel, as you know, reported earnings of about $905 million in 2012, and you're obviously doing pretty well. Why a nearly 11% rate increase request?
Well, overall, Kathy, this case reflects the actual cost we need to incur to provide good quality service to our customers. And a big part of it is the investment we're making into our nuclear plants so that they can operate another 20 years to serve our customers with reliable, low-cost, and carbon-free electricity, and also costs to invest in our electric grid to make sure that that's robust and reliable, and again, can provide reliable service to our customers today and into the future. That's the basic reason for the rate request.
You mentioned the nuclear plants. About 40% of the increase would go for the nuclear plants in the state. What are you planning on doing?
The investment we're making into our nuclear power plants will allow them to operate for another 20 years to serve our customers into the future. That's called life extension. We're also increasing the output of our Monticello plant by an additional approximately 70 megawatts of power.
You mentioned Monticello. I understand that Xcel had cost overruns, particularly at Monticello. Now, if the company doesn't manage the resources very well, why should ratepayers have to pay for that?
For the nuclear power plant, the projects at the Monticello power plant, the actual costs did end up being more than were estimated several years ago, but we've spent what we think we need to get the project done well and safely. There's been a lot of change in the industry in the last couple of years, increasing requirements from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that have helped to drive up the cost of getting that work done.
Now I'm looking through the rate increase request here. About 26% of the proposed hike stems from a drop in electricity usage. It would appear that you're punishing customers for conserving energy.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because that is a big misunderstanding. Conservation has actually helped keep rates lower than they otherwise would have been. And that's because over the last 20 years, the amount of conservation that our customers have done has avoided the need for 10 new power plants. So that's not only kept costs lower than they otherwise would have been, there's also the additional environmental benefit of not having 10 new power plants. That drop is due to the loss of a couple of large customers, also just the continuing sort of depression from the economic downturn. So it's not due to our conservation programs.
So you're asking residential customers to pick up the slack where some of your larger industrial customers dropped out?
Well, we actually spread that across all customers. But one of the things we are doing in this rate case is we're also proposing some new efforts to help stimulate efficient economic growth, and that will help all customers as well.
Commerce Department, as you know, recommended cutting about $22 million in bonuses for Xcel executives and expensive flights on corporate jets. How do you justify expenses like that?
Well, I would say that we have to compete in the marketplace for good quality employees. So we think it's important that our compensation packages really be pegged to the market average.
All right. And when do you expect a decision possibly from the PUC?
We're thinking this fall, November-ish time frame. I don't know exactly, but that depends on how the process unfolds.
That's Xcel Energy Regional Vice President Laura McCartan and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. The debate over controversial new copper-nickel mines in northern Minnesota is often framed as jobs versus the environment. Backers tout the jobs the mines could bring. Opponents ask whether those jobs are worth the environmental risk to the region's lakes and rivers. A recent study adds new fuel to that debate. It predicted several mining projects, both copper-nickel and new iron ore developments, could generate billions of dollars worth of economic activity. But questions still dog the projects, as Dan Crocker reports.
Mining has always been a boom and bust industry on the Iron Range. Take the old LTV taconite plant outside Hoyt Lakes. In the late 1990s, 1,400 workers held good-paying jobs here. But it shut down in 2000, and the enormous metal building has sat empty since. Inside, huge grinding mills, each larger than a cement truck, are lined up one after the other in a space the size of several football fields.
So if you take a look inside, you can actually see that there's rods of different sizes in here. And they break down all of the different rocks into smaller sizes.
Letitia Geetson is a spokeswoman for PolyMet, the mining company that wants to breathe new life into the plant and, local leaders hope, into the entire region. Geetson says the mine would create 360 jobs with an additional 600 spin-off jobs, a big deal in St. Louis County, where the unemployment rate is about 6.5%.
I heard one of our local elected officials once say, you know, if you lose a job in the Twin Cities, you drive another 10 miles to find one. If you lose a job in Hoyt Lakes, you're not driving 10 miles to find another job.
In addition to PolyMet, there are several other new mines and expansions in the works on the range. A new University of Minnesota Duluth study predicts that, combined with already existing mines, they could result in 27,000 jobs and an overall economic impact of over $7 billion. The vast majority of those jobs are the result of iron ore projects, which are still king on the Iron Range. UMD economist Jim Skirla wrote the study, which was funded by mining groups and state agencies. He points to projects like SR Steel's taconite plant being built in Nashwauk, which will create 350 permanent jobs and over 1,000 more during construction.
When you consider projects like SR is a $1.8 billion project, these are huge projects, and that's one thing that I think people have to realize. These aren't tiny little operations that are going on. So when the mining industry does things, they do it in a big way.
But even with such big projects, not everyone is convinced the short-term benefits are worth it. Betsy Daub is policy director for Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness. The group recently has worked mainly to stop proposed copper-nickel mines like PolyMet. But Daub says in the long term, even iron ore mines often fail to create thriving communities.
What we find in almost every study that is done looking at mining-dependent communities, they have some of the highest unemployment rates around. They have some of the highest poverty rates. They have stagnant or declining populations, not growing populations.
Two environmental groups, including Daub's, commissioned one of those studies in 2006 from University of Montana economist Thomas Power. Power has long been skeptical of the promises mines often make. He says historically, mining hasn't been an economic panacea.
You know, we have hundreds of years of history with mining. It's staring us in the face in the Iron Range or the Upper Peninsula or Butte, Montana. How is it that despite the high wages and despite the incredible wealth pulled out of the ground, these areas are not prosperous?
In St. Louis County, where most Minnesota mining is concentrated, the unemployment rate is over a point higher than the statewide average. The county's population living below the poverty rate is over a third greater. Many Iron Range communities have seen their populations shrink. But to people like Jim Lassie, a city council member in Babbitt, a small town near two proposed copper-nickel mines, that's exactly the reason why these new projects are so desperately needed.
So many of our small businesses are struggling. And we're really counting on this to get this influx of people to stabilize our economy and boost us up.
Lassie says Babbitt is already making plans for a possible boom. He thinks Babbitt could grow to around 3,000 people.
I think that would be max. That would mean we'd have to double.
People like Lassie are frustrated by PolyMet's now 8-year-long environmental review process. but he hopes Babbitt moves one step closer to a possible economic payday this summer when the project's revised impact study is set to be released.
That's Dan Crocker on the NPR News Update on this March 4th. Thanks for listening. I'm Phil Picardi. I'll be back with more Minnesota news on your schedule tomorrow.